I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Nick Lobel-Weiss, co-founder of NYC Medics, an organization that provides healthcare relief to victims of natural disasters around the world. Nick and his colleagues started NYC Medics in 2005 in response to the earthquakes in Pakistan. Welcome.
Thanks.
Prior to your paramedic work, you were a theater production manager. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I went to college and majored in theater and economics. And by the way, in college, I became an EMT, which is what I am now. And I spent the first 10 years of my career managing Broadway shows. I was the production manager for The Lion King. I was the manager for Riverdance, the musical Annie on the Road. That was really what I used to do. I really enjoyed moving people from place to place, you know, which would be the actors and the stagehands and the kids and the dogs in some cases.
And how did you go from moving lion costumes to moving sutures around the world?
Well, I was 9/11, so to speak. I was living in New York and found myself working downtown with the relief effort for some time, and that made a big impact on me. And I think that it really put my career in perspective, and I had to ask myself some tough questions about why I was doing what I was doing.
And then you became an ambulance driver.
I did. I took this EMT certification, and I began driving driving an ambulance and working as an EMT in New York. You would meet people from every borough of the city and in small houses, in large mansions, and you know, you'd meet them in a time where they were a little vulnerable and you were able to make them feel comfortable. I feel like in some ways, being sick is the great equalizer. We're all sick at one time or another and we all have accidents. And it brings out a different part of everyone. People respond in all different kinds of ways. You'd find people that would be nasty to you on the subway, but once they're in trouble and you're there to help them, they're your best friend. Mm-hmm. And maybe they would never talk to me if I was sitting across from them, you know, at a restaurant. But once I was there to take care of them, they, you know, they would be so grateful. And that was very addictive almost to be able to help people like that.
How long were you driving an ambulance before you started to do hands-on relief work?
About 2 years.
And then Hurricane Katrina happens, and you went down as under a FEMA contract. How long after Hurricane Katrina hit did you go down to the site?
We wanted to leave the morning after the hurricane had passed, and we waited, and we waited. It took about a week before we had the final approval to get on the road to head down there.
The idea for NYC Medics or New York City Medics came after Hurricane Katrina, kind of accidentally, after the earthquake in Pakistan. How did you first hear about the earthquake in Pakistan?
I heard about the earthquake, I think, the way a lot of people heard about it. I read it in the New York Times and heard the articles on the BBC. I think a lot of people were surprised by this and surprised by hearing about more natural disasters. But something else surprised us even more after the earthquake hit is that after a few days, we didn't hear it in the news anymore. It seemed to slip away. And I think that was frightening to a lot of us as emergency workers, knowing that the problems, anything reported initially as so catastrophic, could somehow, you know, slip away into oblivion almost. I think that I guess the country had a certain degree of disaster fatigue at that point.
And there was a non-government organization or an NGO that contacted you and said, will you go to Pakistan and help? How did that happen?
I got a call from a friend who was actually a paramedic working down in Baton Rouge with us. And he asked if I knew any other paramedics that were interested in traveling to Pakistan to work and support the medical relief effort. I had never been to Pakistan. So I had offered to go and contact some other paramedics so that we could put together a team to travel with this NGO. The NGO actually never was able to pull together that team to go. And so we were left with a group of people who had suddenly gotten very enthused about going and helping, and then they didn't have an avenue with which to do it.
How many people are we talking about at this point when you were gathering a team?
Initially, it was just 10 people. Because we thought we were going to be part of a larger organization. And then for us to hear that we couldn't go was almost disappointing.
Of those 10 people, how many were male and how many female?
We had, of them, there were two, we brought two women in our 13-member team, which is what the final number was when we left for Pakistan.
Now, you also sought help from the World Health Organization, the WHO. Did they agree to help you?
They did, initially. The WHO was going to make us contractors, and we were going to work under their auspices in Pakistan. And that ended up taking, from a bureaucratic perspective, too long.
So that never happened?
That never happened. So we still would be waiting for the WHO contractor status today.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nick Lobel-Weiss, co-founder of NYC Medics, a group of healthcare workers that provides disaster relief to victims around the world. In a way, maybe it's helpful that you did become a WHO contractor, or that this NGO, this other organization fell through, because you might not have had the catalyst to then start NYC Medics yourself.
Right. There are so many things that put us in an unusual context to pull this organization together. We shortly thereafter, we had given up. We had all but given up, and we heard from another organization who thought they could help us, which was Islamic Relief. They, with knowing very little about us, without us even having a bona fide organization, went and purchased airline tickets for us. And within a few days, we were on our way.
Wow. So that's for about 15 people. That's about $15,000 to $20,000 that they gave you for airline tickets. Pakistani Airlines allowed you to transport your materials or your baggage for free. How much baggage did you have?
We had one large pallet, which was over a metric ton. Now, remember, when you go to help in a disaster situation, you can't be beholden to anyone or anything in any way, because you're there to help, and you have to be one other ingredient that is added that doesn't require any support whatsoever. That means water. That means food. In this case, we actually brought our own water. We brought 169 gallons of water from New York to Pakistan, which seems like an impossible feat.
Who was the water supplier?
It was Fiji Water, and they do a lot of other work in the world that's just fantastic. And the joke would be, we were trying to explain when we finally got to Kashmir to the Pakistani soldiers that we were working with that this water had come from all the way in the islands of Fiji, all the way to some port in the West Coast, to New York, and now all the way to Pakistan.
What else did you bring other than 170 gallons of water?
We brought water. We brought food from a company called Tasty Bite, which is where they produce the Indian foods that you'd find in the supermarket shelf that you could boil in a bag. We brought lighting. We brought batteries. We brought flashlights. We brought the medical equipment that we could borrow from hospitals.
How about in your personal sack? What did Nick bring?
It was like going for a really long camping trip where it would be extremely, extremely cold at night and very, very warm during the day. So I had a sleeping bag. I had another physician had been able to appropriate lots of inhalers. So I brought those little asthma inhalers that you'd have for your kid.
Why did you have asthma?
I didn't, but we knew that there were going to be a lot of children that had upper respiratory illnesses. And we actually gave out all of those inhalers to people.
This was probably far from your mind, but just in your personal moments, when you had a moment to kind of reflect, did you bring a book or any music with you?
I brought my iPod, and I brought a copy of the Quran, which I had from college, which I had never read before. But the truth be told, there wasn't really any free time to do any pleasure reading or music listening. Mm-hmm. We were working most of the day, and at night we were either sleeping for, you know, any hours that we could.
One supply that you were missing was a satellite phone when you arrived in Pakistan.
Right.
And finally, when you got to this camp in Kashmir, you ran into a 60 Minutes camera crew. And there was a little quid pro quo there. Tell us about that.
Well, what happened was, we were supposed to be in one part of the country. We were dropped in the wrong place. We were dropped in a town that was 30 miles from the place we were supposed to be. And remember, there were no roads at this point because all the roads had been destroyed by this earthquake. So we found ourselves without the sat phone that we were supposed to have upon arrival. So we had no way to call home. We had no way to call the embassy if something was wrong. And we just continued to work with the people that were there, which was the Pakistani military. A few days later, after we had continued to work like this, we saw some Western appearing people on the helicopter pad when we were loading a patient into a helicopter. It just so turned out that it was a producer from 60 Minutes, and they had just been taking some footage, and we sort of bumped into each other unexpectedly. We taped a piece with them, with the 60 Minutes crew, and some more people came to interview us. And at the end of the piece, they wanted us to be sure that we wouldn't speak about this story, which we didn't even consider to be a story. We just considered it to be what we were doing with any other news crews. There were no news crews for hundreds of miles. I couldn't imagine. We were so in the middle of nowhere that we would never have the ability to tell anyone anything. But in exchange for promising that we would not discuss this with anyone, we convinced the CBS crew to give us their CBS sat phone, and they did.
So trading exclusivity for a satellite phone.
It was a great deal, and we benefited from it, and also benefiting from it were all of these Pakistani military men who had not been home since the earthquake, and so we let them use CBS's dime to call their families and tell them they were okay.
Oh, so nice. Now, how did you end up in the wrong place? You said, who, by the way, transported you to that wrong place?
The WHO gave us a GPS latitude and longitude and said, this is where there's the medical camp where you need to be. And when we arrived at the location that he told us we were going to, which they had named all of the places. They named this Vermont Hospital, apparently. And it was nothing like Vermont, I assure you. We were so happy that he had dropped us off there. We gave him the bottle of vodka that we had purchased at the duty-free, which is quite a thing to provide someone with in an Islamic country.
Sure.
The helicopter took off, and we began to meet the military, the Pakistani military, that were on the ground. And they told us that we were in the complete wrong place. Mm. So as we looked up, we realized the helicopter was far too away to come back. So
now, when you say the wrong place, did it really matter? Because these were also earthquake victims. So what was the right place, so-called?
You know, as we learned, where we were dropped off was precisely the right place, because through this small accident, we ended up being the most forward deployed medical team in this valley, the Jhelum Valley. Mm. So we reached people that had still 22 days after the earthquake had still not seen any medical care. Mm. And we're not talking about major surgeries. These are people that had small injuries to their hands or to their head that just because of the lack of basic medical care, treatment, cleaning wounds, antibiotic administration, were dying. Mm. And were very sick, and people and small children that were dehydrated. So we were in a really fantastic position to help people.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nick Lobel Weiss, co-founder of NYC Medics. We'll hear more from Nick coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Nick Lobel Weiss, co-founder of NYC Medics, an organization that provides healthcare relief to victims of natural disasters around the world. Nick and his colleagues started NYC Medics in 2005 in response to the earthquake in Pakistan. Now, you mentioned that right after the initial earthquake that 25,000 people died, but that 75,000 people died later due to lack of medical supplies, even as simple as antibacterial ointment.
Yeah, I think that, and those are estimates. I think the interesting part here is that so many people, thousands of people died that first day. And in the weeks after the earthquake, there was a whole nother second death toll that began to rise. And it's completely understandable when a country's entire health infrastructure is ripped apart like that. People have nowhere to go. There's no hospitals.
How were you received?
We were received as guests. And in an Islamic country, no one could wish for any other type of welcome from the people. It was almost embarrassing how well we were treated, and we felt guilty all too often because people were really willing to give us whatever they would. The example would be if someone had a chicken that was laying eggs for their family, they would want to cook that chicken for you. And that's touching, because you know that is their source of food, and it's so important to them.
Now, you've been to Pakistan twice. The first time you were in Kashmir And the second time you're in the Northwest Frontier Province, where there's known to be some terrorist activity. And I'm wondering if you ever felt that your security was threatened despite your being received with open arms by the locals.
We always felt so comfortable. We were right there during the whole debacle that took place with the cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. So there would even be protests at certain times on a Friday. However, we would see the people that would march by protesting would wave to us as they were marching by. So they were cognizant of the fact that we were there, and we felt separate from these concerns that people may have had with other people in the world.
There was a Mujahideen training camp on the other side of the mountain where you were in the Northwest Frontier Province. These are groups of people who might have terrorist connections. Were you aware that there was a training camp, and did that at all? Did you at all worry about your security?
It was pretty scary when we found out about that. We didn't know about it until we were actually leaving. We found out at the end that there was this Mujahideen camp, which apparently, as it was explained to us, these people were not plotting attacks outside in the world, but they were just preparing or training to protect what they considered their land in a border dispute they have with India. But at the same time, having any type of a militant group, that was somewhat frightening to us. However, we were assured that through the whole time we were there, they knew that we were operating on the other side of the mountain, so to speak, and they were apparently okay with that.
People knew that you were American, but you weren't necessarily holding an American flag or anything like that, so you were kind of nation agnostic to some degree.
Right. We tried to be. It was probably quite difficult to hide that. People that came to be treated by us knew who we were, but we tried to keep our mandate in somewhat of an international context.
Now, while you were in Pakistan, Bush came through, and Bush wanted to meet with you, and you declined. How come?
That was a tough decision because at the time, there was a real security consciousness there, obviously. And while we were there, like you said, we were trying to keep a somewhat low profile. Everything had been going very well, but we didn't want to make waves. And the problem was, if we were to agree to meet with this person, we would have had to disclose the area which we were working in publicly in a major newspaper. And as everyone knows, Bush is not very well liked in Pakistan at all, and I certainly wouldn't want to have a photo of myself with him shaking his hand and being affiliated with that, and I think that would take away from what we were there to do, because we were in Pakistan not with a political agenda, and a politician is, and I think that's really what it came down to. We wanted to keep our independence.
You worked alongside the Pakistani army a little bit, and one of your colleagues, Steve Muth, said that Pakistani soldiers are professional and their work is exemplary, and that the people of Pakistan should be proud of their military. I was curious about this because the role of the military in Pakistani society is not unequivocally a positive one. They are ubiquitous in Pakistan. There's a huge bureaucracy, and they really control almost every facet of society. And Musharraf, the prime minister, came in with a military coup overthrowing the former prime minister. And so there's a real kind of air of menace and disapproval of the military. Why was there this approval on the part of you guys or on the part of your colleague towards the military?
Yeah, I think that there may be, and I'm not a real expert on Pakistani politics, but what I can tell you is that there seems to be two levels of the military, and I'm sure Steve would agree with this. There is a bureaucratic upper level of military management, and I think that is the area that may be more associated with the government and the power structure. Then there is a more development-related part of the military there. This military in much of the country is reflective of its citizenry.
Do they wear uniform?
They do wear uniforms, and it's funny, actually, when they're doing work, they have these sort of tracksuits that they wear, and it seems like they're all on a soccer team of sorts. So
do they carry weapons?
They don't necessarily carry weapons. There is a very large contingent of the military, which is the equivalent of our Army Corps of Engineers. They were making roads the day after the earthquake, and we would hear in the mornings, we would hear explosions and we would be worried at first. But that was the military bombing out, not bombing, but using the charges to create, to open up the roads again.
Incidentally, going back to this security question, if a member of the Mujahideen training camp, or if there was an Al-Qaeda training camp near you, if one of those members had come to you to be treated, would you have treated them?
We wouldn't have known if they were a member. And
had you known they were a member?
Had I known they were a member, the truth is we have to treat people based on need. And it, to be an international organization and to be able to be effective in what you do, you need to really accept people for who they are. We wouldn't treat people that were threatening our workers. We wouldn't be treating people that were threatening our patients. But if someone comes to us with their hat in their hand or in an inappropriate manner who's needing treatment, it's pretty much an accepted international doctrine that it's appropriate to treat them.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nick Lobel-Weiss, co-founder of NYC Medics, a group of healthcare workers that provides disaster relief to victims around the world. NYC Medics was started in 2005 after the Pakistani earthquake, which claimed over 100,000 lives. Nick worked as a theatrical production manager prior to his work in healthcare. I want to go back to the resource question.
Sure.
How long were you in Pakistan the first time you were there?
The first time we were in Pakistan, we were there for just over 2 weeks.
And the reason you left was a resource issue.
Sure. We weren't even an organization yet. We had nothing other than what we had brought with us. And we knew, not only had people all taken off work with taken unpaid leave off of their jobs, you know, this was not very unplanned, but also we knew we would eventually run out of water and we would run out of food. When we finally did leave, we were able to hand off this location of treatment to larger organizations, like in one case, the Pakistani Physicians of North America came in. They took over our camp.
So you're a mobile unit that is quite nimble because of your small size.
Right.
So you can get in quickly and get out quickly, and you kind of fill the space for larger organizations that require more time for coordination.
Precisely. There are a lot of organizations, major organizations like Doctors Without Borders, that have all of the resources, the tools, and the talent to provide this type of care, not to mention the United Nations. However, when a disaster happens, there's often a gap that we found that exists between the search and rescue phase, where people are literally there trying to find people in the rubble, and then the reconstruction phase, where the larger organizations can come in and provide, you know, set up programs and really help people in a long-term context.
I want to talk about gender roles. Cultural tradition causes a separation between men and women in places like Pakistan. What were some instances where you faced a gender issue firsthand?
We faced a lot of issues there, and I think we also didn't find what we expected. When we were in Kashmir the first time, right after the earthquake, we found not all women were completely covered. Kashmir, in some places, is more liberal in that context, which is surprising to many.
Still, male doctors were touching, naked females. How was that received?
We found that women were comfortable being treated by men in an emergency context. We brought two female practitioners the first time. And the second time, our teams were made up almost 50% of women. And that was very helpful. And I also found that in that part of the world, the social norms might not support women being treated for all their needs in an emergency in the same way that men would be treated, and that was disturbing to me.
What's
also, finding the right supplies. Like, for example, we had two people in our camp that were working in a health clinic, and they were unable to obtain pregnancy tests from the pharmacist because the pharmacist accused them, the local Pakistani women, of running a brothel. And that's disturbing, where a woman should have the right to know if she's pregnant.
Now, there was a Pakistani midwife, Nigat, who was with you. What role did she play?
She's actually the woman who provides this example of wanting to go into town to provide these pregnancy test strips, or to procure these pregnancy test strips. We, the American males, would go into town to the pharmacies to purchase these items. And they were, she had been turned away when she went to make those purchases.
How about psychology? The field of psychology is not accepted in Pakistan. It's shunned upon, even prohibited. Did you find circumstances in which you felt people needed psychological help but weren't able to get it?
Absolutely. Well, after a disaster, everyone is living in crisis. People were coming for treatment, but we'd find children that couldn't speak. And we weren't sure if they had a physical problem, and then we later realized that they were shocked out of communication. There were kids that were afraid to be touched by anyone, men, women, even their own parents. And we thought at first that there might be a neurological issue, that they had some type of a head injury, but that wasn't the case. The case was that, you know, they had witnessed possibly the death of their entire family. But like you said, psychology and psychotherapy is not a practice that's accepted in Pakistan. I think it's probably more appropriate for someone to speak with their religious leaders, which can be a form of psychotherapy. I think when the second time we came, we almost brought a contingent of psychologists.
So you're still willing to do this despite the cultural tradition which supports otherwise?
Yeah, I think a lot of international medicine has these challenges of trying to provide, well, we were always endeavoring to provide what we would consider first world medicine in a third world context. And that's a challenge.
When you were in Pakistan, how much did it remind you of Katrina?
I feel in Katrina, we had lots of resources and a lack of ability to mobilize those resources. And in Pakistan, we had a huge desire to mobilize. If we needed some support from anyone in the town, from the military, we had it. If we needed to go hiking through the mountains, the next morning we found a whole regiment of mules to carry all of our stuff. When the mules couldn't go any further, there were men that would come. Not only the military men would take all of our bags off of the mules, but just people from the village were carrying everything we had. So what we had in Pakistan was we had lots of mobilization, but we didn't have the resources.
Very, very interesting.
So it is an interesting juxtaposition. And if just given the resources there, you'd be amazed at what these people could accomplish. They were so determined and tough.
How about at night? I know that you were, you know, working around the clock. Did you have enough lighting to continue work into the night?
That's a really good point. The first time we were there, we had a very small generator, but we had very little fuel, so we couldn't run our operations. We found the Pakistani people would basically be ready to end their day when the sun went down. As a result, everyone was up as soon as the sun was even remotely in the sky. And it was a huge shift for us, you know, to operate, to get up at 4 or 5 in the morning. But people in that part of the world live by this sun, and it gave us a new appreciation for the light that we have.
And has that affected your own circadian rhythms or your own behavior now when you're back in New York?
It has a little. I find myself waking up a little earlier in the morning. But it was interesting. And the second time we were in Pakistan, we had more power. We had generators. We had the ability to purchase fuel. So we were one of the few relief operations that could remain and have a 24-hour emergency room. There was a woman that was in a car accident, and she was brought in. The whole family was brought into our emergency room in the middle of the night. Her son was brought in with her. He was not injured, and someone gave him a lollipop, and it was a mango lollipop. And I remember just watching this child in horror, watching his mother on what we would have as sort of an operating or treatment table. And all he had to comfort himself was this lollipop, and it was very sad. It's just sad when there's a car accident in Pakistan. There could be a car accident anywhere in the world. The difference there is that there's no lights on the road. Their headlights may not work. The driver may have been up for 2 days because they had to work so hard. Remembering that car accidents happen there for all sorts of reasons is something I don't forget.
How does choice play a role in your treatment of some of your patients in the field?
In international relief, all too often, unfortunately, people are treated at the direction of and in the style and manner of the people that choose to provide the care. There were times where people would want to be given medications and it wasn't medically appropriate for them. And in that case, the choice is a difficult one, where we want to treat them in the context which they're interested, we also feel the responsibility as a practitioner not to give them a pain medication when we feel that that pain medication could be harmful to them. And that's a place where the choice can't necessarily rest with the patient.
How did people treat your leaving Pakistan?
That was tough. It was very difficult. As the reconstruction phase in any country happens, people do go home. And that's an important part of the process, because more than being wanting to be treated by us, the people there really want to be able to take care of themselves, and they should have the rights and resources to do that.
I've heard that the Kashmir valleys are the yeah. most beautiful sights of nature in the world.
Yeah.
Does that stay with you at all?
I do. Even the picture on my cell phone when I turn it on all the time is a picture of the valley there, and those images will never leave my head. They're indelible.
What are some specific moments or instances that you remember that come up in your daily life when you're brushing your teeth or driving your car?
I think about a child that was about 5 years old, and he had lost a portion of his leg, and his father needed to carry him everywhere. And I remember just helping, and I cleaned the wound and rebandaged the portion of the leg that remained that had not been amputated. I think a lot about how tough it is to live in Kashmir, and these people will walk for several miles to get anywhere. And I think of how difficult it's going to be for him as he continues to grow up and support his family when he can't walk because he only has one leg. And he's still there, and I'll probably never meet him again.
Do you care to meet him again?
I would love to. I can't even remember his name.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
My guest has been Nick Lobel Weiss, co-founder of NYC Medics. Coming up, we'll meet Donna Rubin and Jennifer Lobo, co-founders of Bikram Yoga NYC, a chain of hot yoga studios with temperatures at roughly 100 degrees. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Donna Rubin and Jennifer Lobo, the founders of Bikram Yoga New York City. I'd like to start off by understanding what Bikram Yoga is.
Bikram Yoga is a style of yoga, and it's actually named after the man who started this yoga. His name is Bikram Chowdhury. He basically put together a series of postures that works every single part of the body in the 90-minute class. He's the first person to basically put it into a hot room or heat the room up.
Now, just how hot is it?
We say approximately 100 degrees. The heat is really there to help you warm up your body, and you can really get very deep into your postures more quickly than if you did a regular yoga class in a gym or something like that, where you would have to spend quite a lot of time warming up before you could really get sort of maximum benefits and maximum flexibility, let's say.
And Jen, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think you feel the benefits from Bikram Yoga almost immediately after your first class. And that is because it is such a full body workout. And when you lie down at the end of class in Savasana, your body really does feel a tingling sensation all the way from the top of the head down to the toes, all the muscles, the tendons, the ligaments, joints. The whole body's been worked. And you walk out of class and you just feel very light and very relaxed, energized all at the same time.
I would like to read to you some commentary that I've seen by some of the people who have benefited from Bikram, and I'd like you to speak to it a little bit. I began practicing Bikram yoga a year ago because of severe back pain, and I have been attending 3 to 5 classes per week ever since. Any physical pain is completely gone, but I have discovered many mental benefits of the yoga as well. At work, I can handle stress better than ever, and I'm more focused and happy at work. So this person had severe back pain. Have you had clients with hip pain or back pain and they claim that the Bikram has relieved their symptoms completely or at least partially?
Well, there's so many people that have come and have solved so many of their problems. It's unbelievable. But the interesting thing is that when people come, they might come for a particular reason like the back pain. And because they're feeling better, they keep coming. And then they start to get all the other benefits that yoga has to offer.
Another paragraph I read was by somebody who said that he was fat. And after 2 years, he lost 30 pounds and he feels so much better about himself. Have people lost weight from this as well?
Absolutely. Particularly men seem to lose a lot of weight. Everybody slims down. We like to say your clothes end up fitting better. You might change your clothing size, but you might stay the same weight because you're building muscle strength as well. It's amazing how many men we've seen walk through those doors with a beer belly or, you know, just haven't exercised in years. They sit behind a desk all day and they come 3 times a week, no more. And within 2 months, they've dropped 20, 25 pounds.
I want to talk about Bikram Chowdhury. Mm-hmm. He founded what we call Bikram Yoga. What's his background?
Well, Bikram is from Calcutta, India, and he was a national yoga champion. He started off actually as a weightlifter, right? And he had a lot of injuries, I think mostly knee injuries, but his whole body, you know, from extreme weightlifting was in disrepair. So he started practicing the yoga over there, and he met Shirley MacLaine over in India, and she said, and she took some yoga classes with him, and she said, you've got to come to the United States and teach the people in Hollywood specifically. They really need your yoga. So in 1973, he came over to Beverly Hills and started giving classes, and he claims, you know, that there was a line out the door for people to try to get into his class. And that's really how it started. And then years later, he started doing the teacher training.
Yeah. I mean, he always felt that in order to learn Bikram yoga, you had to learn it from him. One of the funny things that he says is, Hollywood entertains the world and I entertain Hollywood.
I think that's one of the cutest things that he says.
Donna, how do you think Bikram feels about your taking his name and using his yoga and benefiting from it financially?
That's really his ultimate goal. I mean, he really wants his yoga everywhere in the world. And the only way he gets that is by us, by people, you know, using his name.
Is there some sort of license sharing agreement or anything like that?
It's been on the, you know, when we first started, on the looser side at that point. It was a loose affiliation. But like I said, he was happy to have his name, you know, be there and to have us send people to his teacher training. So that was very good for him as well. But as it's grown and the way it's grown so much and, you know, the amount of publicity that certainly we've gotten in New York, and I mean, he certainly had his own publicity in LA, that I think he's had a lot of people tell him that he needs to be more organized about how he, you know, arranges his agreements.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guests today are Jennifer Lobo and Donna Rubin, who founded Bikram Yoga in New York City, the hot yoga, as it might be referred to as well. We're talking about Bikram Chowdhury, the founder of the whole yoga exercise, Bikram Yoga, and we're talking about how sort of outspoken he is. What are some of the things he'll say to some of his clients, Jen?
He pretty much is one of the few people who can tell people what he feels, and somehow he gets away with it. So he might see a beautiful actress who looks perfect from the outside, and he'll just look at her and say, "You look nice from the outside, but your body is junk. You need to come to me every single day for the next 2 months." And they do. And they come. And, you know, it changes their lives.
Well, how did it change your life? Jen, how did you get involved with Bikram Yoga initially?
I was living in San Francisco. I was working in sports marketing. And I was really into sports. I was playing in year-round soccer leagues, indoor, outdoor leagues. I was running marathons. And I had a couple girlfriends who were doing the yoga. And they said, "Jen, you should really try this yoga. I think you'll like it because you're athletic and people who are athletic tend to really like this style of yoga." So I said, "Sure, I'll come." And I had a couple friends in town from New York, and we were, you know, on the party circuit that weekend. And we were out at dancing, going to bars and late, out till 4 in the morning. Got home. The class was at 9 a.m. the next morning. I just thought yoga, what everybody thinks. I'm going to go in, I'm going to lie on my back, and I'm going to do some breathing exercises and probably fall asleep. It'll be fine. So we show up. The place is packed, packed, packed. I said, it's hot in here. After the half moon pose, which is the first posture of the class, and you're not really warmed up yet, and it's a minute posture and you're holding it, I look over at my friends. I say, you've got to be kidding me. This is hard. I'm seeing blurry in the mirror already, and it's only first 5 minutes of class. So we're laughing, and the teacher keeps saying, girls in the back row, please pay attention, pay attention. So we got serious. Well, we made it through the entire class, God knows how. But after that class, I felt as if I hadn't even gone out the night before. I just felt amazing. And then that was it. I was hooked.
How did you then get back to New York?
I worked for IMG, the sports marketing company. I was transferred with the company, and there was no Bikram yoga here at the time. There was a place that had a few classes, but they weren't really pure Bikram yoga. The room wasn't very hot, and they weren't a full hour and a half class. So it just didn't feel the same. I just started talking to one of the teachers who was actually certified by Bikram. And I said, it's really a shame that there's not a proper Bikram Yoga College of India, which we call ourselves, as an affiliate of College of India. And she said, well, you really should meet this woman, Donna Rubin. She's certified and is looking for a partner to open a studio in New York. And we had lunch.
Donna, how did you catch the Bikram Yoga bug initially? What were you doing prior?
Well, I was a professional dancer, and I was on a tour of the musical Carousel, and it was like a year and a half tour across the U.S. I was always, you know, trying to find a way, A, to stay in shape while you're on tour, and B, to, you know, get your body warmed up and feeling good to do the show. And I noticed, well, at that point, I was just going to the gym every day. And I noticed that my body was getting stiffer and stiffer. And I was sort of right at that age where the, you know, your body starts to change a little bit.
What age were
you
at?
35. Mm-hmm. And I started to get frustrated. And I said, boy, I'm spending so much time just preparing to do the show. There must be some, you know, something else I could be doing. And a couple of the other dancers were doing yoga. And I had a preconceived idea about what yoga was, and it didn't really interest me that much. I really wasn't interested in meditating or, you know, just doing very simple, easy, you know, type of postures. But I noticed that they were having no problem staying flexible and doing the show. And I kept asking them, what are you doing? But then for some, you know, strange reason, I happened to be in Florida visiting family, and again, looking for a place to stay in shape. And the only thing that was around where they lived was a yoga studio. And I was sort of peeking in, you know, and I saw this little man in this kind of bikini bathing suit, and all these people were like sweating and everything. So I said, well, here we go. I guess I'll just jump in there and check it out. And I was like, this is really hard. What is this? I was really struggling. And I was looking at these other sort of middle-aged people, and they're going ahead and they're doing this class and everything. And I'm kind of struggling through the class. Anyway, by the end of the class, I thought, wow, this is the most amazing thing I've ever done. And I got in better shape doing that than I had doing anything else, even my dance classes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Jennifer Lobo and Donna Rubin. They are the founders of Bikram Yoga in New York City. We're talking about how they got introduced to Bikram Yoga initially. Now we're at the point where you both have this Bikram Yoga bug. How do you then go about starting your own studio?
Well, I mean, I had never thought that I would own my own business. I mean, that was the last thing in the world I ever thought I would be doing. I mean, I really didn't want to end my career as a performer at that point, but I also needed something else to do to make some money when you're in between jobs or shows. And one thing led to the next, and I thought, well, maybe I should try to start teaching this as a way of making money and see if I actually like to do it. So what I did was I kind of rented my own little studio and invited my own friends to come to my class just to get a feel for it and see if I liked it. And I really started enjoying teaching it, and my friends really enjoyed doing it. So it became a very positive experience. I said, you know what? This could be a very good opportunity for me.
You said that you didn't have any business experience. Like, just how bad was it?
I mean, I was dancing since I was 13 years old. And, you know, the only thing that was important was dancing and being a performer. So I had absolutely no experience doing anything. I mean, in terms of anything practical.
How about using a computer?
Like, I was afraid of the computer, okay? Mm. Afraid of it. But the interesting thing was, is because I knew that this was such a good thing to do, an idea of opening up a studio in New York, and I knew that it was going to do well. I just knew it in my bones. It just didn't stop me. I just had this clear picture and this clear vision of what I wanted to do, and I'm going to figure out how to do it. So then it was a matter of looking for the right person. It was basically after having the one lunch that we had together, and I just felt that the connection that we had, or the skills that we both had, were so completely different that we would complement each other.
Jen, you came offering not just your PR and marketing expertise, but also in investment. How much did you contribute initially when you were getting the business off the ground?
At the time, it seemed like a lot, but in retrospect, it seems like nothing. I think it was $67,000 or something like that.
Roughly $70,000?
Yeah, something like that. At the time, it seemed like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money.
Absolutely.
But as we've seen the business grow, and as we've had to make renovations to spaces and take over other spaces, in the big picture, it wasn't a lot of money.
Right. And how did you go about finding your first studio?
I really wanted to open up in the theater district. Again, I really felt that same experience that I had when I was on tour, that it would be great to have a place that you could go and do your exercise and warm up and get ready for a show. You know, that was why I chose the theater district. You know, within such a short period of time, we were overflowing. But, I mean, it was the first studio in New York, right? So
you were overflowing.
We were
because
overflowing.
Were you doing any advertising?
No advertising, nothing. But it just so happened that we were very lucky, and one lady did come in and take class, and I had no idea who it was, who she was, and she happened to be a writer for Elle magazine, and she happened to love it. And, you know, she said, oh, you know, I'd like to do an interview with you. Is that okay? And I was like, yeah, sure. And I was so busy just being concerned about running the business that I took it very, very lightly. And I had no idea that she was going to do like a feature article with a full picture and everything about it. So that was really lucky. After that, we were just packed.
That first week, what did you do with all the money? I mean, you're not this business person. Jen, you are. But Donna, do you have any recollections of how you felt when you had all this cash coming in?
It was just the strangest feeling in the whole world. I guess I never had any cash coming in. And I had the money all over the bed. And I was just like trying to pile it up together. Oh, my God. Look at all this money. What do I do with it? How do I deposit? Where does it go? What is it? I was just like, I was frightened. I think 2 weeks went by before I made a deposit.
I'm Jessica Harrison. You're listening to From Scratch. I'm talking to Donna Rubin and Jennifer Lobo today, the founders of Bikram Yoga in New York City. And they were very successful very early on. But I'm curious as to what problems you might have had early on. What were some surprises?
Well, I think one of the most difficult things about opening a business is all the hoops you have to jump through to actually get the space built out with the building department and permitting and contracting and elevators, getting equipment up and down, maintenance problems that might come along, trying to get the right people to come fix things.
And in addition to having these challenges on the plant and equipment side, what about employees?
Well, the teachers were very difficult to come by at the beginning because there were really hardly any certified teachers. I mean, the teacher training was really very new. When I did it, only 34 people were certified. Wow. That's a big country out there, you know. So, and we were, you know, wanting to expand, and we didn't have teachers. So we would pay to send people to the teacher training so that, you know, they would come back and teach for us.
And how much does it cost to go through teacher training with Bikram?
It's very expensive. I mean, at the time, it was, I think,
$4,500,
and now it's up to $6,000, I think. It's a very big commitment financially and even time commitment. I mean, it's a full two and a half months of your time, full time.
Right, but it was very clairvoyant on your part to say, you know what, I am going to dish up the $4,500 because we need good teachers for quality control. Mm-hmm. Did you have any other problems with your employees?
Staffing is one of our biggest problems. And, you know, at the beginning, I treated everybody as they were my buddy, my friend, and that we were lucky to, you know, to have anybody who wanted to work for us. I didn't realize that we were in the driver's seat and that we should be more tough and make more demands. Because if somebody is doing something that we're not happy with, it's hard for us to tell them. Do you fire them? So it's a tricky thing. And I guess it's called human resources. And of course, since I never worked in a business or any kind of big business, I didn't even know what that meant, human resources. So
right. Donna is our HR department.
I guess so.
You're the boss.
I guess so. I guess we're the boss, right?
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guests have been Jennifer Lobo and Donna Rubin, co-founders of Bikram Yoga NYC, a chain of yoga studios in New York City. If you'd like to listen to the show online, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com. If you have questions about the show or an endeavor you're trying to get off the ground, please email us at talk@fromscratchradio.com. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.